Well, a massive new demonstration against plans to build a mosque just steps from Ground Zero here in New York City.
Quite a scene today outside a Bridgeport mosque where Christians and Muslims discuss recent tensions between their faiths.
This mosque that they're trying to build, all it is a training center. And where are they? In the center of Tennessee. They're going to say, we have conquered Tennessee.
Tensions building over the placement of mosques in New York City, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Protests have also sprung up in California and Florida in the past few weeks. What is it about a mosque and Islam? That's the subject Graham Fuller explores in A World Without Islam. In his book, Fuller asks, would the world be any different if Islam had never existed? Graham Fuller is former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, and he joins us from his home in British Columbia, Canada. Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Lynn. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Now, this really, the title of your book is very provocative, A World Without Islam. It sounds like a polarizing statement or question, but let's get started by letting you explain. You're not suggesting there ought to be a world without Islam.
No, not at all. What I'm really suggesting is that in terms of East-West tensions, I'm not saying the world would not be different if we didn't have Islam, but I'm saying in terms of tensions between the Middle East and the West, the world would not be greatly different. And that's the basic reason is because when you come to look closely at the sources of conflict and grievance, you find that almost none of these have anything to do with religion and everything to do with international politics, oil, colonialism, imperialism, wars, one thing or another, but almost nothing to do with theology or religious issues.
One of the points you make is that it's not about religion, and to quote you, it's about, quote, dogmatic thinking. Is that correct?
Well, that is true, because I do argue that any time a state or even an individual takes up an idea and pushes it to the wall for other purposes, and we see this in Nazism and communism and fascism and in radical Islam or extremist Judaism or any of these other things, you find an unyieldingness, a confrontational character that is, but it's really the religion or the ideology that's the flag for something else, and we have to get below that flag. The person who's carrying the flag, what are they really trying to get at, and for what are they and their community willing to go to war for or even die for? And it usually is not over small theological issues.
Couldn't part of what you're saying be taken to extend to the three major monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam?
I think, you know, almost any religion can be abused, has been abused in history, but I wouldn't even stop there and just say, well, it's all to do with religion that can become fanatic. It's very important, for example, if we look at the last 20th century, which is the most hideous history in the history of the human race in terms of people butchered and killed in wars, and if we look at it, all of it has to do with secular movements in this particular case. Communism, fascism, communism moving to China.
But it seems to me that you're letting a few things slip through. You don't talk at all in your book about the oppression of women by some of the sects of Islam. And hasn't that been a catalyst for an awful lot of, at least, ill feeling?
Well, I think that a great many Muslim countries have a great long way to go in terms of improving their record on the position of women. But it isn't true strictly just of the Muslim world. I mean, so much of the developing world has serious problems in this area. But, Lynn, what we're really talking about here is incredible modern violence of warfare and bombings and all of this stuff in which these issues are not what is at stake. That's not why people are going out and blowing themselves up. It's because they feel deep grievances. They're angered that their countries are being occupied, foreign troops rampaging around in their countries, huge civilian casualties, all this kind of thing. That is what will get people out. It's a sense of anger, revenge for those actions. History did not begin with 9/11 as far as the people living in the Middle East are concerned.
So you do devote a chapter in your book to solutions. Can you sum it up very briefly? What do we do now?
Sure. Well, I basically argue that if you look at the history of grievances that go way, way back, many hundreds of years, and that have gotten worse from a Muslim point of view over the years with more warfare, more intervention, more propping up of dictators, more American and foreign troops on the ground in their country, more forces stationed in their countries, whether they're at war or not, these people basically have to come home and let the Muslim world start putting itself together again on its own. I mean, our country knows what it's like to be under foreign troops, and the troops in our country were of the same language from England in the Revolutionary War. So we've got to show some ability to understand how others might think about the presence of these massive armies, and it's growing. The interventionism is growing, and of course the opposition to it is growing. So my brief, basic, it's kind of simple at this point, but look at the evidence, is to get our troops out of these places, let people begin to get on with their lives. Most Muslims are not at all fanatic and have very little desire to get involved in these things, but they can be radicalized by radicalizing conditions and forces, and I'm afraid that's what we're creating now.
Clearly, your position is very controversial among many people. You're suggesting we get out of these countries. Isn't that abandoning the people that are there who believe we came in to help them?
Well, I mean, there's hardly a country in the world in which, in theory, you couldn't argue that there would be reason to go in. Well, why didn't we go into Rwanda and help people there who are dying in massive numbers? Why aren't we going into the Congo today, where 2, 3, 4 million people are killing each other? We're very selective in this. Where there's oil, or where there's geopolitical interests, or if we want to checkmate the Soviet Union, then we go in. But if it's not about that, then you know there's a on here, and it hardly even makes the nightly news.
Let me, as long as you brought up Rwanda, let me just very briefly, quickly ask about sub-Saharan Africa. Islam is growing fastest there, I believe, than anywhere in the world. What changes will that bring?
I don't think it's going to bring huge changes as long as these countries are allowed to work these issues out on their own. Muslims and Christians and Jews have basically gotten along very well together in most of the on most of the world for a very long time. Of course, conflicts here, there, elsewhere. That's true of the entire world. But I'm saying we can get back into that. We can go back to those conditions if people are allowed, if people are left alone and allowed to go about their own lives and work out these problems themselves. How are we going to be able to, you know, parachute into northern Africa or other places where the cultures are extraordinarily complex and sort these things out, especially when it's when half our interests are to establish military bases as part of a Pentagon vision of global dominance?
Graham Fuller, author of the new book, A World Without Islam. He is also former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council. This one will get you thinking. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lynn.